Hey there, my name is John Dyer, and I'm so happy to be able to be with you, at least in this virtual format. I've really appreciated the Ecclesia project and wish I could be with you, but what a great way to celebrate technology than to use technology in a new way for this conference. So I'm delighted to be here and just to kind of kick off our plenary sessions and just talk a little bit more about where technology fits in the story of God, to talk about creativity, the image of God, and what it means to be a maker and a user of technology. So we're going to look at the place of technology by kind of walking through the biblical story again and looking at it kind of freshly in a new way. And I think what I hope we can do is that if we look at the biblical story through kind of a modern technological lens, that will help us to sort of take the life of God and have that story be shaping the way that we look at our world today. So we're going to look through this and we're going to kind of take us through these different stages of, you know, creation and fall and then sort of waiting and anticipating for Jesus to come, then what we see in Jesus and what we see in the restoration of all things in the future. So I'm going to spend a few minutes telling you a little bit about myself and then and my family and set the stage for where we're going to go after that. So this is my family. The lovely kids were at that stage where they're getting into middle school and we're learning a lot about how to parent through technology. My wife has been a literature and philosophy teacher for a long time and is now a headmaster at a school. So she's delightful and wonderful and interesting. And so we have a lot of fun together. But my role over time has been both a kind of a theology professor, and I also spent some time working on things like online education technology. So I wrote a video player system that was working for Dallas Theological Seminary. And eventually that is open sourced and went out to a lot of the internet. So I like to make things that, you know, are end up being used by a lot of the world out there. And yet sometimes I wonder if, you know, the video player that I made that's probably been used billions of times over the last 10 years, did it make the world a better place? Did it help some developers? Maybe it was used for some Christian content too, but what is the meaning of the things that I'm making? Now, on the other hand, I also make some sort of Christian stuff. I made, you know, we all know YouVersion. I made YallVersion as just kind of a fun demonstration of what happens when we find all the second person plurals in scripture and we show them in the English language that we have here in the South where we say y'all. And if you go to YallVersion, you can also change it to Yous Guys or Yins or other regional dialects like YouLot. So kind of make technology experiments that show us something about our faith. Like worship.ai uses AI technology to generate worship songs. And so we get a little bit of information about what is AI doing and what are we putting into it and what's coming out of it. So these are the kind of things I love to make. And so sometimes on my screen, I'm doing things like what I'm doing now, but sometimes I'm also doing things like this on the screen. And I've been a kid who loved technology for a long time. But for me, one of the questions that's come up is this one. When we think about the nature of technology, what do we mean by it? Is it something that we can say, is technology a good thing? Is it something that is mostly kind of bad that we're just dealing with as Christians? Or is it just something that's neutral that we just need to use well and not use poorly? And so I'm gonna give you some examples of this, right? We've got this little girl who's getting a 3D printed arm. What could be more redemptive and good than that? This little boy is going to hear his dad for the first time when he gets this cochlear implant. You say, I know sometimes cochlear implants can be difficult for hearing impaired communities because of what it does culturally, but man, that's a good thing. This is Rosalind Picard up at MIT. This is her work on facial recognition, not for ads, but for helping autistic kids to be able to read facial expressions. And we think about the last year, you know, the church in the pandemic timeframe and these images that we have been seeing over and over and over again about the creativity and the wonder of what people came up with during this time and the ways that people and families lived together. So we have all these wonderful things we do, and yet we know these other things about technology. Like we know that Instagram and some of the other social networks contribute to negative mental health, and sometimes we know that, you know, pornography and that industry can be so destructive to the people who are in it and the people who are watching it, and it can be kind of complicated. And we know that for our children, this is not a question of if they're going to ever see this, but this is just a question of when and how they're going to handle it and what it says about men and women's bodies and what it says about healthy sexuality and where we go. And this is one of the things we're hitting. We know in the last about decade, since really around the time when the iPhone was released, that we've seen an increase in suicides, even while we had a decrease in homicides for young kids. And we can't blame this on the iPhone. We're not going to say that this is the fault of Steve Jobs. But we do have to wonder what's going on in our society. And for the last several years, we've been inundated with fake news and the questions about what is really truth and who is giving it to us. We also have the family questions about each generation seems to treat technology a little bit differently. They understand it in a different way, and they use it in a different way. So we have different debates about who actually pulls their phone out at dinner, and it turns out it's the boomers. It's always the boomers, right? So we've got this, and by the way, I fit right there between, I'm a Zennial, right, between Millennial and Gen X. So I kind of fit both ways. I like avocado toast, but I'm still pretty angsty about my mortgage. I'm right there in between. So, you know, we have these generational questions, and we have our kids, right? And they're looking at us and they're saying, what exactly are you doing with that thing that you hold all day? What is it that you're using that thing for? And we have future and fun questions to ask about technology that I won't get to talk about today, but in another lecture, maybe that would be fun to do. So if we think about this, we say, okay, so is technology, is it something that we can say, is it good or is it bad or is it neutral? Now, if we were together and we were doing a poll, and I ask you to raise your hands, and we maybe did something maybe in our Zoom session where we could do something live, and we gave a couple of seconds and we waited. Here's what I'm going to guess you would say. Most of the time, there's a few people who raise their hand for good, and a few give a couple examples for bad, and they say, on average, I know there's some good and some bad, but I feel like it goes this way or this way. 90% of the audience will say, I think technology is just neutral. And what I want to try to do by the end of this session is to change your mind about that. If you're in the neutral camp, here's what I want to do. I want you to see technology as theologically good, full stop. That this is something that God has given us and is, by its nature, good. Now, we know that there are uses that are good and bad. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about it by its nature. Not to be distracted just by good and bad uses, but to think about what it is. And then at the same time to say that either, whether we're using it for good or for bad, it still is going to have a formative effect on us and our communities and our cultures around us. What that does is it says, hey, maybe there is some sense in which technology has a moral neutrality in some way, but I think what we want to do is we want to claim it for God and for his glory and for the image of God as his image bearers as a good. And then what we want to do is say, when we use it, how is it forming us, our heart, our mind, our soul, our relationships, and our culture and our society, so we can be informed in the kind of decisions that we're going to make. So if we're thinking about what we mean by technology, there's some fun definitions out there. Alan Kay invented the mouse, and he would say technology is anything invented after you were born. So for some of us, you know, the things that were before our time are just the way the world works. And then everything from 0 to 30 is the cool stuff that we want to use. And everything after 30 is the things that are the destruction of society and the degradation of our children's minds. So what I mean by technology, I'm going to take kind of a broad view, and if we had some time to think about it, we could talk about the difference between ancient tools and modern devices, but we're going to talk about a lot of the things that humans make. And the point that we're trying to get at is this, is that when we think about something like a technology in a church, like a projector, there was a time when I was a youth pastor, and I'm wondering, hey, can I get a projector in my church? Because some of my kids use printed Bibles, and some of them don't. And we pass out the printed Bibles, you know, like youth pastors do. And this is a little bit before the age of phones. And so I thought, I'm going to get a projector in here, and I'm going to use it for good, and I'm not going to use it for bad. I know the difference between those two things. Well, of course, like many of you, you find that when you put a projector in a place of worship, there's these unintended things that happen, right? The kids stop bringing their Bibles to church. And I come from sort of the Bible church world, and that's a big deal. People want to have their Bibles and know where their verses are. And when they don't bring them, that could be considered kind of a bad thing if you're a Bible person, right? But at the same time, I also found there was this wonderful thing where all of a sudden, instead of every kid having their own translation and their own special cover of the Bible, now they're all reading the same text at the same time, like we would be doing together if we were in an audience room. We would all be looking up at this screen at the same time, reading this text at the same time. And there's a certain kind of recollection of unity that happens in that. Back to the era when we didn't have individual printed Bibles, where we just heard the Word of God proclaimed. And in those moments, we're all hearing the same thing at the same time. That in some ways, the projector takes us forward and backward at the same time. And so we would say that God's word hasn't changed in its nature and what it is or what it says. But when we change media, whether we're using it for good or for bad, it's going to have these changes that are going to occur at the same time. So what we're trying to be able to do is this idea that we see technology as having these intentional good and bad things, but we want to become adept at seeing unintentional positive and negative things that occur as well. So if we were to take ourselves through, you know, the biblical story, what I hope we see is this idea that technology is good And yet it's always going to come with these unintended effects. And the way I like to kind of put this together is to say, technology is this God-given transformative force. It's something wonderful for us, but we want to understand its transformative force more in a deeper way. So as we think about technology, we think about these great thinkers that we have that we can go back to, like Neil Postman, great guy, worth reading. But he would say things like this, that technology is not part of God's plan. And I think Neil's wrong. I don't think he understood really what God was doing in the story. So let's go back to this idea of the story of God. Let's start at the creation. And let's say, what did God say about creativity and making? And how does that help us understand the digital age in which we now live? So when we open up the Bible and we think about the very first words of Scripture, the very first thing we see, the first time we're introduced to God, is this idea that God is a creative God, that God is a maker, that God is someone who his divine love and creativity and action and relationality in the Trinitarian divine life is going outward, that from the beginning, God is a maker. And then when we look at what the way that he makes, I think as a maker myself, that there's something beautiful about this, right? That if we kind of break down the days, we see the first day is some separating. He separates light and darkness. And then he separates the sea and the sky, the waters above and the waters below. Then he separates the land and the water, and he makes these things. And then the next 3 days, he fills them. He fills with the sun and the moon and the stars, fill the light and the darkness. That the birds are up in the waters above and the fish are in the waters below. And at the end, then he creates humans and animals to fill the land. There's this idea of God is making one set of things that he's separating, and then he's filling these with appropriate things. And then he's ending it with this day of rest, right? This time of looking back on his creation, saying, wow, this is amazing what I've made. And when we look back, we see the reason for this in a minute. We can talk about why rest is there. But I think there's a couple of amazing things that we can see, even just in this, about God's own creative purpose. We can think our process. How did he make? And does that tell us anything about how we can make? If you've read ancient creation myths that are in the same maybe time frame as Genesis is being written or compiled, most of those stories have gods in chaos. They're battling each other. They hate each other. There's one is chopping up the other, and the guts hit the ground, and then humans spring to life. And this is this wonderful story of order, of God doing something that has a process and a procedure that he's doing. And I think there's a way for us to use and create and make in a way that has a certain kind of order. But yet this isn't a rigidity, a thing of just ducka-ducka and numbers, right? This isn't just spreadsheets and code. This is also beauty. I think of Mako Fujimura, who would say, I like to think of that God's creativity is poetic, and so should ours be. That this motion of these days and this mapping together, that there is sort of a symmetry and an asymmetry to it, that there's a back and forth happening here. And then I think for all the debates about creation and science that sometimes happen in our faith, this is one of the most beautiful passages in the way that it all fits together in the rhythm of the passage. That wherever you land on those things, man, God is a God of beauty. And yet also there's a purpose, there is a reason for each of the steps that he's doing. That each of these first 3 days that he's carefully making spaces, and then he's carefully filling those on the days. That man, the way that he makes things, when you have seen an artist or a coder or a builder make something, and each step makes sense, this is the way that God is creating as well. And yet he also puts a kind of limit, right? That the best kind of creativity is one that has a form of some kind. So when we have a poem that has a certain rhythm to it, that limitation, that symmetry, that structure is what can make it have beauty. And then when you choose to break it a little bit, that's what actually gets our attention as well. So to have form in music or in poetry or in art or in code, those are the kinds of things that God is setting out, I think, in these days of creation. I think it's also an act of divine love for him to say that he is fully sufficient in who he is, that the Father, Son, and Spirit are happy in their perichoretic dance. And yet they choose to move outward into the world and to make something that didn't exist before. And so there's love at the core of it. And then I think at the end too, the part where he breaks the rhythm is this odd day, the seventh day of rest. That, when we look in the Old Testament, that in Exodus, when the Ten Commandments are given, that it seems like rest is looking back at creation, that this is a celebration of what we've done. The reason why we rest is in order to celebrate, right? And then in Deuteronomy, when God talks about this again, he then talks about their emancipation from slavery. that to have rest is to not be enslaved. And I think about today, so many of us are glued to our devices. We're constantly on all the time, right? And we think about this, we never have time to celebrate what we've made, nor do we have time to be free from the things that we've made and from the things that are around us. I think God is showing us in creation a way of creating, a way of being a creator that can have order and beauty and purpose and limits and love and rest built into all of this. So I love God's creative process. And then I love when he's creating each of these animals and each of these things, they each have a purpose that we kind of, when we look in the Hebrew, the fruiting things fruit, the flying things fly, the swimming things swim. And then he comes to you and me, and he says that humankind, their thing is to be made in his image, that male and female, that they have inherent dignity and worth and value and honor by being God's children, that all of us and all of our diversity and all of our differences, that we reflect and we get to enjoy it being part of the image of God. And so what I think we're going to see in this is that if God is a creator, the first thing we see about him, that part of our image bearing is going to be using and making technology, using and making things that have purpose and order and rest and love built into them, that these are going to be part of what it means to bear the image of God. Now, we know that the image of God is a humongous concept, but at least part of this is going to be our creativity. And, you know, the Genesis 1 kind of creation story, there's that sort of other creation story in Genesis 2 that tells it from a different angle or a different theological perspective. And in that story, God then creates a garden for us. He takes the natural world of trees and he creates something special in a garden here. And yet, we're introduced in Genesis 2 to this idea that there was no plants yet in the garden when God started. And he gives a couple reasons for this. One of those was that there hadn't been rain yet, but the other one is this idea that there was not yet any humanity there in order to cultivate or keep it. So you have these two Hebrew words here. The word for cultivate is kind of through the Hebrew and then the Latin. We eventually get the word for culture. So all of the objects and images and language and art and music and food, all the things that make our cultures and our subcultures and our intercultures, all those overlapping senses that give us meaning and identity in the world. This is what kind of that word culture is. It has usually a tool making or a using idea. So it's the idea that you would be using a hoe in a garden or moving things around, that you're going to make something from what God's made. Yeah, there's also this idea of keeping, that it has a word there that can mean guard or preserve. A soldier would keep a guard tower. But in the context of this area, I think what God is saying is that he's looking for Adam and Eve to look at what he has made and to make things from it, to look at the river and build a bridge over it, to say, I want to put these plants together with those plants, to begin to care for it, and to not, at the same time, to guard and to preserve it, not to just wantonly use everything, not to just burn down the fields and throw all the dirt into the river, but instead to keep it, to guard it, to preserve it, to protect it. And so we're called to sort of make from what God's made and also to protect it. And I think about my own children, you know, they're getting older now, but when they were younger, we all loved Legos. And I delighted in dumping a box of Legos on the ground and just seeing what they would make with it. And I think that's what God wanted from humanity. And that he also wants them to keep it clean at the same time, right? Like, I want my kids to do that. And so I think that in this sense, we are given here in Genesis this balance in our call to create and to preserve, that we are called to care for God's creation. We're not called to fill it up with smog and to destroy it and to overuse it and to strip mine it and to dump in the ocean. We're called to preserve this, to make sure that we don't burn up the world that God has made. So I think here we're getting this balance here, that we are called to make, but we're also called to preserve. Well, you might be wondering, okay, so this all sounds fine, but do Adam and Eve ever actually make anything? Do they actually create anything before evil and all that stuff is in the world? Well, they do, actually, right? If you recall, later on in Genesis 2, God actually asks Adam to make something. And the thing that he asks him to make is the names of the animals. So when we think about these two that I have on the screen here, we have two names. I'm not going to say the words, but I want you to just think about them for a minute. And if you think about them, one of them is named for its function, and one of them is named for more of its form or for what it looks like. And so those words end up sort of shaping what we think about those particular creatures, right? That the name starts to color or change the way that of what we see of that person. And I think maybe that's an extreme example, right? I'm using sort of pop culture imagery to do that. But I think this is actually true of a lot of our language, right? So if I were to ask you to picture these two people, to develop a picture in your mind of what a doctor and a nurse are, the chances are that you might have labeled them the opposite of what I'm now showing, right? And that's because there's some language bias, some gender bias built into our language, that there's sort of this underlying expectation that a doctor is going to be male and a nurse is going to be female. Now, that's not true. Of course, men and women are both fully capable and excellent at both of these jobs. But there's a bias built into our culture that puts that attaches those into those words. So if you were to feed those words into sort of an AI processing engine, it would pick up those same biases because of the way that the words are built and then the structure of the society around that language. So we think about this all the time with words, that when we see these words, and if they're on resumes, they get treated differently. There's a systemic way in which we treat people with different names in different ways. And there's all kinds of other labels that we use that determines what we think or don't think about a particular person, right? So the point I'm getting at is this idea that language is humanity's first technology. It's the first thing that we make that really differentiates us, that makes us able to do all kinds of things that we do today. But it does shape what we see and what we don't see about the world. Some of our most wonderful and beautiful things are in our languages, and some of our worst biases are in our languages. What I think is lovely about this is that God is portrayed as creating the world through language in Genesis 1. And as a person who likes to write code, I love to create things through language and get to write code, and something happens and these machines just do what I ask, and I think find it to be amazing. So never underestimate language. You know, even when we're thinking about the internet culture today, right? That we're kind of moving into a mixed use of language, where originally the way that you would text would be sort of the way that you would write. And now the way that we text is a little bit more of an oral kind of tertiary orality type of way of speaking, and we kind of mix it in with emoticons and different language sets, and even some of our little acronyms like LOL, you know, sort of used to mean I laughed out loud, and sometimes now it means lots of love, or it means all kinds of different things. That language is malleable and changeable, and that if you know a language, or if you speak it without an accent, that you're an in-group, right? And if you speak it with an accent, you're sort of an out-group. And so if you understand TikTok dances, or if you understand certain YouTube subcultures, those are all these sort of language cultures that get created that help us to feel like we're part of something, but also can make people feel distant at the same time. And so as we think about the way that we use our words online to both be giving and loving and generative and creative and forgiving and making and knowing, we have a power in language. And I think there is a sense in which in the digital age, it's possible that language can become more debased. Some of the way we used it, particularly probably in the last 5 or 6 years of just frenetic social media usage, we may be degrading our language and degrading ourselves. And so what I don't mean is that you have to speak the most proper English and you have to have an accent that is like this or mid-Atlantic. What I mean is that we want to care for the words that we use and the way that we use them with people. Well, of course, we're eventually going to get to this era that we sometimes call the fall or sin. And it is hilarious that one of the world's most valuable companies uses this symbol. And of course, they didn't mean this to mean this. But, you know, sin comes into the world. There is evil. We know that it is present, and we know that it affects us and it affects those that we love. We know that there is sin done to us, and sin that we do to others, and sin that is in the world. And we struggle with this. And I think the fundamental thing that I think Adam and Eve are struggling with in the garden is just this question of who we are. You know, God has given us this idea that we are made in God's likeness, that our dignity and our value is based on us being image bearers of God, not anything that we do, not anything that we own. And there's always this temptation to very simply make this shift that we want to become godlike, that we want to evolve past our current nature, our limitations. You know, we can see this in movements like transhumanism that I think have a lot of good and potential. They want the best for humanity. But if we kind of cross over into that post-human area where we want to leave behind our bodies, I don't think that's probably the healthy direction. That's not exactly what Adam and Eve are doing, but there is a sense in which they are wanting more than what their creaturely goodness would have them have. And so I think there's always going to be a temptation for us with technology to want to have more godlikeness, and we'll talk about this as we go along. But the fascinating thing about, again, I know we're still just kind of in Genesis 3 here, but when Adam and Eve when they sin and God comes after them, they hide. And the very first thing they do, though, is they recognize that there's a problem now in the world that they want to do something about. And so they engage their creativity. They make something from the world that God made. They decide to make clothing. So they make these clothes. And when God comes and there's the curses on the serpent and on the ground and all these things, when God looks at their act of creativity, he doesn't condemn it. He doesn't say, oh, you shouldn't be using it that way. Instead, I think he shows them how to make it better. He shows them how to make something that is more redemptive, that overcomes more difficulty for them. And we know that there's a potentially a theological richness here where Adam and Eve are trying to sort of cover over their own problems by themselves. And God is saying that I'm going to need to come and do something, and it's going to become costly, and something may need to die for it. But one day I will make all things right. I think there is a sense in which this is looking forward to Jesus' coming, looking forward to his sacrifice. And yet I think it is also God saying that there is a new sense of your creative powers, that originally God's command to fill the earth, to multiply, this is in part, you know, having babies, right, and moving around, but this is also filling with art and music and culture and technology and shovels and space shuttles. This is part of it. But now there's a sense in which part of technology is overcoming some of the effects of the fall. This is one of the things that we're going to be doing with our technology today. One of the things that is both lovely for us now, because we are able to say, man, we can take away suffering from people with some of the things that we can make, with some of the things that we can restore. We can have masks and vaccines and these amazing things that we've all seen in the last year in the midst of just millions of people dying, that millions more people were saved by this technology. And yet we can also say, one day those things will never be needed again. One day God will make the world where we don't need masks or vaccines or defibrillators or respirators. So this is again, a deep part of the biblical story, is that technology takes on this new sense of overcoming the fall, both giving us foretastes of a new world, but also giving us a little bit of reduction in suffering today. So we move on, though, in here in Genesis 4, we get to this interesting statement where Cain kills his brother, and God says, it is time for you to go wander. But from Cain, we actually get him, his decision is to make a city. And from his descendants, we get sort of a lot of strands of human culture. We get music and the lyre and the pipe. We get agriculture and animal husbandry. And we also get tools made of bronze and iron. So all these different strands of human culture are kind of put together here of human history, of moving from being, you know, hunter-gatherers into city makers. And so, you know, if we trace through theologians like Jacques Ellul the idea of the city, a lot of times the city kind of takes on a negative connotation in Scripture. It's often condemned or it's cursed. And throughout all the different stories, the city sometimes has this mixed bag to it. And yet we're seeing here that Cain really has no interest in God. He has no interest in Yahweh. He has no interest in following these things. And yet from him and his descendants, they cannot take off the image of God. They cannot undo that. And so we see that this part of God's creativity is flowing through men and women who are far from God. And I think we see this today. We see millions and millions of people who really are not interested in God, or maybe have been hurt by the church, and yet they are so brilliantly creative in what they make. The challenge, I think, is that sometimes there is a sense in which the city for Cain can be kind of functioning like an anti-garden. It's a place that insulates himself from his need for God. He has all the things that he needs. He doesn't need any of the things that God would provide for his soul or for his body. He only needs the things that he has. And so we see this temptation to reorient technology as this, not just a provider of goodness, but as a source, an ultimate source of hope. So we have the famous statement by Nobel that he thought that his dynamite would bring peace. We have the Wright brothers thinking that their airplane would bring peace. And we have our gentlemen today, who are our technologists today, who oftentimes are talking about that this is the transcendent good that technology can be. And they do produce a lot of great and good things. And yet I think there is a sense in which we can see the ways in which technology can fuel our selfishness and our self-directedness, our self-reliance, and our pointing toward ourselves, instead of our outwardness to our love for God and neighbor. And so I applaud those of you who are technology users and creators that are able to capture the part of technology that helps us to love God and love neighbor, to take that original command of God to fill and multiply the earth, and also to overcome some of the effects of the fall. And I think we see this, even though there is this negative tendency in us to misuse technology in this way, I do think there is a part of God who is going to be intentionally using technology in story after story, and making human creativity part of the story. And this fun one of Noah's Ark that we often tell for rainbows and kids and animals, is also a story about creativity. It's a story about God saying, I'm going to deal with sin and evil and death and destruction in a way that makes human creativity part of it. And so if the flood is something that is happening in some area of the world and that there is some destruction happening, God could also part that or levitate Noah in the story, Noah and his family. God could have done this in any number of ways. But in his wisdom, it seems like God takes verse after verse a lot of care to tell Noah how to make this boat. And so again, we have a Christological story, a Christotelic type idea here, where we have a righteous man on a construction of wood going over death and destruction to save the human race, this sort of portrait and foretaste of who Jesus might be. But I think this is also God saying, I care about the things that you make so much that I'm going to make them part of the story that you tell of my interaction with the world. So that God is saying, I care about these things and I'm not going to let them go. I'm not going to let them become so distorted that we don't talk about them again. And even some of our favorite stories, like the Tower of Babel, God, again, could have said, this tower, this is an abomination, and I do not like it, and it is not for me. But instead of doing that, instead of saying, I'm going to destroy your tower, God is saying, what I want from you is to fulfill that idea that you're going to go out and fill and multiply the earth. And so when God comes in and sort of hacks at them, he doesn't destroy the tower and just plink it off. Instead, he's saying, I'm going to work at that fundamental human technology of language. I'm going to use that as a means by which I'm going to accomplish the things that I want to do in the world. And it's going to actually produce more flourishing, because the more languages, the more diversity, the more cultures that we have, the more humans are creating more things for more good, right? And if they're monolithic like that, it may not work as well. And so God is, I think, concerned with them wanting to have God-likeness, but I think he's also concerned with their good here as well. And so I think this is God again and again and again saying his interest is not to destroy technology. His interest is to redeem it for human flourishing. And I think we can see this too as we move along to the Israelite people. But one of the fascinating stories that I think we see is as we go through the Exodus journey and the people are emancipated, they come out of Egypt and they're in the desert, and there's this interesting moment where Moses goes up on the mountain and Moses is receiving the Ten Commandments. You start maybe in mid Exodus 15 or something like that, Exodus 20, and God starts to give these different commands. And while he's up there, the Israelite people are down below, right? And they are kind of in this displacement. You know, the biblical story can sometimes be understood as from place to displacement to replacement, right? That we move out and back in again. And in this moment, they're in a place of displacement, that they had a world that made sense to them, an order and a structure of life. However horrible it was to be in Israel, to be in Egypt, the Israelites, as they come out, they're thinking, this kind of stinks. I don't really like this. I feel uncertain. I don't know where to go. Life doesn't make sense. And so their response to this is that just as Moses is coming off the mountain, just before that, they finally are just they have too much anxiety about the world, too much anxiety about how things are going to go. And so they engage their creativity and they make the golden calf. And we usually say, golden calf is an idol. You shouldn't have idols. That's bad. But I think what they're doing is that in a time of uncertainty, in a time of displacement, they're trying to make anchoring things in the world, sort of rituals and places and things that make their life make sense. And so it's natural for us to create in that moment, when we feel anxiety, to make rituals of life that will make life make sense for us. Now, when they made this, the irony is the very next chapter, right before this, is God telling Moses, I'm going to do something very, very special. I'm going to take all of these ideas that I've given you, all these abstract theological ideas, and I'm going to take somebody, and for the very first time in Scripture, my Spirit is going to descend on a person. And this wasn't Abraham and Sarah. This wasn't Moses and Miriam. This was Bezalel, the creator, the person with skill of making things with his hands. and the rest of his crew. Here, the Spirit of God descends on him and says, this is largely a literate culture, but I'm gonna show you how to make symbols and ways of being in the world that will remind you of who I am. So everything in this tabernacle, every smell, every slaughter, every gold item, every diamond, every part of the chest piece of the priest, all of these communicate meaning and identity and significance to people. And what I think is happening here is, in a sense, what we've experienced in the pandemic in the last year or so, our entire lives were disrupted. Everything that made sense to us changed. And in those moments, we were all looking for ways to have our life make sense. What do we do? How do we structure our life in such a way that is life-giving and not draining? We know Zoom is great. It was super helpful. And yet we can't do it all the time. So I think this is God saying, the kind of patterns and rituals and images and technologies that we use, these are deeply important for what it means to be human. And in fact, we actually see this baked into the Ten Commandments here, where the first commandment is theological, that there are gods, but there is only one God like Yahweh, and you are not to have any other God before him, that he alone is the one God. But the second commandment is about how we use images to sort of enact that theological truth, right? That God could have had a like all the other elements of the tabernacle, there could have been an official thing that said, this is who God is. This is the Yahweh doll that everybody buys. But instead of doing that, what God said is that I'm going to do something different. I'm going to not have an image of me. Because that form is going to communicate the message that God is not like the other gods. He's not just another doll that can be made and destroyed that's inanimate. That God is not like them. And that God is different, that he is irrepressible and not containable. And so I think here, even in the Ten Commandments, God is saying that the words and images and symbols and patterns around our life, they are powerfully formative to us and who we are and who our relationships are. So I think about, you know, this morning was one of those mornings where I got up to my phone alarm and I pretty quickly started checking email and checking some news. Man, half hour went by just like that. And it kind of ruined my whole day, you know? And I thought, man, if I had been smart and had put my phone in a charger in a different room and had an alarm in a different place, I would have started out my day a whole lot differently. So I think for all of us, we need to be aware of, if we want to be creators and makers, we need to have spaces where we have images and symbols and patterns and rest and quiet and lack of distraction and notifications turned off on our phone in order for us to be able to have the kind of life that God wants us to have. We also see in the Old Testament some ideas about how we create. Some technology ethics are built into some of the laws of the Old Testament. So I just want to give you one of them here. It says, when you build a new house, make a parapet around the roof so that you may not bring the guilt of bloodshed on your house if someone falls from the roof. Just such an interesting little command there. And I think this is something for us to keep in mind as we create things, that we are not God and we can't know every way a tool that we make will be used. There's no way for us to account for everything, but we do need to have built into our processes kind of iterative design, and we do need to have user testing, and we do need to have quality assurance, and we do need to have ways that help prevent these kinds of errors. And I think as an engineer, I'm not going to build a house with a guardrail around the top of it, but I do want to be thinking about how the things I make are being used. And so I think whether you're in Silicon Valley or you're an architect or you're at your own home, you want to be thinking about, how do I think about how I structure my life in such a way that it is most maximally beneficial to the people around me? How do I even love my neighbors? And this comes to the area of where we put highways in, right? That sometimes highways can be deeply destructive to particular communities. So as we think about the world that we're building and what we're trying to accomplish, we want to be aware of these kind of ethical concerns that are even built into the scriptures. We also want to be aware that, you know, individual technologies like a sword can be used to kill somebody, but there's also technologies that have a more systemic sense to them. And so one of the most repeated commands in the Old Testament is this idea about dishonest scales and accurate weights. So you can see I've got a million references here from Leviticus to Proverbs through all of the prophets in the Old Testament. This is a repeated theme that God is saying that systemic evil and systemic good that can happen through laws and through technology, these are deeply important to God. That these are things that we want to be aware of. Yes, individual technologies and the way that I relate to my wife or my kids or my coworkers, those matter. But so too do systems of technology like scales, because you can cheat one guy out of a few dollars, but a scale can cheat an entire city. In a modern system, a website or or an AI system can cheat lots of people. And we know through our experience with social media over the worlds and the algorithms that are present in those systems, that those affect a lot of people. And so we want to be aware of those things, because even in the New Testament, there needs to be an awareness that even a lot of the things that we're doing, that we're not just struggling against, again, flesh and blood things, that there is going to be a spiritual component to this. It's not as if God in the spiritual realm is not present in the internet realm and all of the worlds that we're in. These are present in here. And so we want to be careful that we are not contributing to the kind of exploitation that is so easy to do with technology, and the more power that we get with it and the more wealth that we can gain. So we want to also be speaking for justice in terms of the types of laws that are passed and the way that they go. But I do want to give you some hope. So this is waiting up to Jesus. There are some fun things at the end here when we get to this redemptive part of the story. We do come to Jesus. And the fascinating thing, I think, again, about Jesus is that there's this little Greek term, tekton, that's used to describe his father. So when Jesus comes back to Nazareth and he's preaching, and they say, isn't this Jesus, son of Joseph, the tekton? So tekton is a word that we have translated carpenter in most of our modern translations, but it originally kind of means an artisan or a craftsperson, someone who makes something with his or her hands. So this can range from kind of a blacksmith to a carpenter to a stonemason. And so we think, you know, in church history that Jesus' father probably was a carpenter, and that's why we translate it that way. What I find very, very interesting about this is that, you know, Adam and Eve were originally given this idea of being makers and fillers of the earth. That was part of their image bearing. And they were also called to live righteously, and they failed on both accounts. But when Jesus comes into the world, you know, it says that the scriptures tell us that Jesus, that the world was all made through the Son of God, that he made the world, and yet the world rejected him. And then when he comes to the world, that his own creation turns on him again. And yet he fulfills what Adam and Eve could not do in terms of both their creativity and in terms of his righteousness, that he's doing both things, that he is the ultimate human in the way that he lives. And the interesting thing is that the technology with which he worked, wooden nails, become the technology on which he died. That again, God could have had his son die in any number of ways. We can be imaginative about this. He could have been stoned, or he could have been thrown off a cliff or drowned. All kinds of ways that he could have been killed. And yet God in his wisdom somehow chose for this thing, this horrible machine, where he took a tree and twisted it into something of destruction. And somehow this becomes the center point of our story, that we don't tell the story of our hope, of our salvation, apart from mentioning the cross, apart from mentioning this heinous act of creativity that God somehow transformed for good, that God made it good in this way. And so in Jesus' death and in his burial and his resurrection, that creativity is part of that, and so is righteousness and goodness. And this is a key, kind of the fulcrum of everything that we do is around the cross. So we move forward into church history, and we see just fun little stories about how the early church decided that, you know, the technology of the day was the scroll. That was what you did if you wanted to have something official, something scriptural, something religious. It goes on a scroll. But for some reason, the early church said, you know what, this isn't for us. We're going to use this newfangled technology of the codex of pages, and we're going to sew these things together and take them out. And so we've never found a scroll of any New Testament writing. There are no Gospels. There are no writings of the New Testament that are ever on any kind of scrolls, because apparently they chose to use this technology of the book. And eventually Christians became known as the people of the book. And we don't know exactly why they did it. It might have been more portable. It might have been that they could put more books together as there was canonical issues. That's a fascinating time in the history of the church. We think of, you know, God and his wisdom having the Roman roads. This is all part of the system of what God is doing in the world. But we also see the authors of the New Testament, you know, kind of wrestling with modern technology of their day. So we see them, for example, John in 2nd and 3rd John, we see this writing where he's saying, I have things I want to write to you, but I don't really want to use paper and ink for some things. Instead, I want to come to you and I want to be face to face, because there my joy is complete. And I think here John's giving us a bit of a theology of technology and communication here. He's saying, man, you know what? Both of these things are incredibly valuable. That if we didn't have paper and ink, we wouldn't even have scripture. and we wouldn't have the ability to communicate from afar to build up the church. And yet at the same time, face-to-face communication is still part of deeply what it means to be human. And so we're not going to pit these two things against each other. You remember probably 10 or 15 years ago, we used to say, is online community real community? Of course it's real community. Of course it's real interaction. Just like a letter or a phone call is a real relationship. And yet most of our relationships are multifaceted. They take place across, you know, email and text and Zoom and in person and lunch and all these different things. The constellation of our relationships is very complicated in its online and offline-ness. I think what John is saying is that there are appropriate places for each thing. So we find in the writings of Paul and the writings of Peter too, that they're going to talk about writing. That sometimes Paul is going to say, I long to be with you. I want to be present with you. Other times he's going to say, you know, I'm kind of annoyed with you people. And so I'm going to write you a letter because that's more redemptive in this case. And I think they're wrestling with what is the appropriate medium to communicate with different people. And I think of all of our local churches throughout the world, all of our little local congregations, and then I think of the church universal, that in some ways, technology becomes the bridge between the church local and the church universal. It's one of the tools that the Holy Spirit uses to bind us together. Even though we have our own differences and our own traditions and our own emphases, that in Jesus and in the Spirit and in the creativity that he's given us, we can in some way experience the oneness that he so deeply longs for us through some of the tools that we have with technology. But you know, we've all used the wrong technology at the wrong time, right? We've all used it for the wrong place. And so if we had another time and you were working together, you want to take a little screenshot of this and work with your group, you could say, which of these activities on the right would be best done on which technology on the left? That you could say, if you're brainstorming or trying to build trust, maybe that's good for in person. On the other hand, there might be other technologies that would be just great for a Zoom meeting, or just great for that meeting could have been an email, you know, that we could do something different. And there's also more difficult ones like encouragement or conflict or apologies in a public setting. We need to think really carefully through the ways that we use our technology for that. And so we're going to need wisdom to use technology to know when. But I also want to point out one of our final technologies that we use quite often that we don't necessarily think of technology. And it's this one, that every time we come together, we celebrate what Jesus did, and we receive the grace through the elements. But it's interesting to think that this is really an act of human creativity as well, right? That God, went in our baptism, that we use the purity of water, but in the Eucharist, we don't. We don't use grapes and grain. We use bread and wine. So every day here, we are celebrating new life and new creativity. That we're celebrating that we don't just have grapes, but that we have all of these wonderful things that help us make grape juice or wine, depending on which group you're in, or different kinds of bread. And I even think the church where my family and I worship, we've been using those little tear-off ones for the last couple of weeks. And I used to hate those things and think that they were the most kind of just automated, systemic, worst forms of technology, least life-giving forms. But in this era, for me, when I hear that crinkle come off the top, to me, it means togetherness and safety. It means that we found a way to receive the grace and goodness of Christ and to remember what he did and what he's going to do in a safe way. And I think I never would have wanted to have those things, and yet it brings me so much hope and so much joy. And so then we look forward every week to what he's going to do. And when we look forward, we don't see us going back to a garden that is empty. We don't see us going back to a tech-free zone. What we see instead is God saying, bringing a holy city down, full of roads and trumpets and banners and all the things that humans make. That God goes out of his way to sort of, if you read Revelation 21, to talk about all of the different elements, all the different materials that are going to be used. And if we go back to Genesis 1, remember when God is giving Adam and Eve this command to create and to cultivate, that all of a sudden there's this little weird part where it talks about all these rivers randomly. And it talks about near them there's gold and there's onyx there. I think those are the things that God wanted us to discover. He wanted us to dig up and to make things from the great world that he made. And here we see it finally happening in this holy city, that gold and the onyx are used in a way that honors God and brings humanity to a place of beauty and life in this new world. And so the portraits of the coming kingdom are not ones of God destroying what people had made, but of transforming it into something that brings about human flourishing, that says swords are plowshares and spears are pruning hooks. And I think we have an opportunity in the way that we live our life to take technology that sometimes isn't so great and to use it in a countercultural type of way that can be used for, I think, for the divine life and for the life of the church and for the honor of God and his people. And so when we think about this vision of the new heavens and the new earth, it's not of wings and trumpet wings and clouds, but it's this world of things that humans make, that God wants to clean out our souls from the damage that is done to us, the damage we do to others. He wants to resurrect our bodies, but he also wants to celebrate our creations at the same time. And so I think there's a couple of questions we could ask. We could say, what are the technologies that are going to be in the new heavens and the new earth? And I think, I don't know exactly what that will be like, and I don't mean to kind of over-literalize the scripture or do anything like that, but it does give us a sense, a question about how can I live today in light of that day? How can I use technology today in light of what life will be like? And if I think about a technology today that I don't think will be in the new heavens and the earth, I could say, well, why not? What is it about that? And why do we have that today? Certainly, like I said, I hope there won't be the need for medical equipment. But what about a lot of other things? What about screens? What about communication devices? And why do I feel this angst about those things being there? So this lets us ask questions about the kind of world that God is making and how we can participate in it. So I hope what we've seen in this is this idea that all throughout the biblical story, God is saying technology is for good. And we know that when we use it, sometimes there's these transformative things that happen to us. When you use a shovel, when you use it for good or for bad, it gives you blisters on your hands. That we're not going to become untainted by the things that we make. And yet that doesn't mean that we have to be afraid of the things that we make, nor do we need to shy away from them in the church or in society. But instead we have this idea that we can use technology in a way that I think honors the God who made us and what he made us to be. And so some of the questions that we can ask ourselves are, instead of saying just exactly how do we use technology, but think about what are we trying to transform ourselves into and how can we use technology in service of that stuff? So how do I use technology in a joyful way that says this is a good gift from God? This is not something to get angsty about, but this is something to say that this is good from God. And at the same time to recognize we are fallen creatures. We are going to fall into the worst parts of it. We are going to use social media in a way that's really just about us. We are going to fall into those angry things. We are sometimes going to make something that's going to have some consequences that we didn't anticipate, and we may need to go back and clean up. So we want to be honest with this in community with other people, who we are and how we struggle with our technology, and recognize there may be places where there are things that we could do and it would be okay, but maybe we won't. Maybe it's something that we say, I don't have to make everything. I don't have to do everything. I can pull out from those things. When I look in my own life, I say, you know, I want to order and structure my life in a way that maximizes my creativity. I want to have structure and limits to my own life so that I can be maximally creative and maximally loving. And that may mean that I just need to go into my phone and turn everything off. That's mostly the way that I do it. Because I find that if I want to be a creator, if I want to be a cultivator of culture, if I want to be not just an angry person who's criticizing things, I do want to speak out about injustice, but I also want to create new things. To do that, I've got to shut some of that stuff down. And so what I'm mostly wanting to do in my own life is to say, you know, in the tech world, we talk about optimizing for something, right? We talk about developing a product that's going to be optimized for something, it's profit or whatever. In my sense, I want to say, in all the things that we're doing, we want to optimize technology for the table, for this life of connection and reconnection that we're all experiencing today. That whatever it is that you do, if you're a creator or a user, that you're saying, what is the table life? What is the value of the kingdom? And how can I direct technology in that way? So I've really enjoyed getting to be with you virtually. And I pray that as you think about technology, that you could say, you know, there are a lot of good things. There are a lot of bad things out there. But I understand that at its nature, technology is something that is good. And as we talk about in some of the other talks, we'll talk about some of the downsides, some of the unintended consequences that come in it, but that we can see ultimately in the story of God and his people that technology is a good gift from God, something that we should use and we have a responsibility to use well and ethically and redemptively. So thank you so much. I look forward to being able to interact with you online.